asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with spring Black Friday savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus leaf blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're discussing why you should be saving less and just keep buying with Nick Majuli.
That's right. Our guest today is Nick Majuli. And Nick, he's the Chief Operating Officer for Ritholtz Wealth Management. He writes weekly on his site of dollars and data. But he wasn't always a finance and investing savant. Before that, he was a litigation consultant, which honestly doesn't even seem fair. Some folks just get all of the brains. But even though Nick, he's had a heart for personal finance, it's only been in the past 5 years or so that he actually started seriously writing about money. And his new book, Just Keep Buying, it actually comes out tomorrow. We were lucky enough to get an early copy, and it is fantastic. Nick weaves insightful stories with actionable advice that is going to help anyone who reads it. We can guarantee that. We're excited to talk about the book much more today. Nick, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Appreciate that, man. Thanks, Joel, for having me on.
Yeah, we're glad to have you, Nick. And yeah, we've been reading your blog for a couple of years now, at least.
Yep.
And it's definitely one of those that we go back to every single Tuesday when it drops. So the first question that we ask anybody who comes on the show is, you know, Matt and I, we like to drink craft beer. Everybody knows that by now. But it's something that we splurge on right now while we're saving for the future and investing well. Do you have something like that? What do you like to splurge on? I know you live in New York City. Is it just trying to find the best burger every week? Or yeah, what's your big splurge?
I think my splurge is restaurants. Like, I like going to nice restaurants.
Oh, it is.
New
it
stuff.
Is burgers.
Yeah.
You're closer than you thought, Joel.
It's more like dry aged ribeye. Like, that's really my splurge.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So I'm a little more fancy on that part. But yeah, outside of that, like, I'll admit I'm a little bougie when it comes to restaurants. Like, I'll buy like $8, you know, V-necks from Amazon. But then if I go to a nice restaurant, like, I have no problem, you know, spending good money there. Especially post COVID, like, I really support the restaurant industry. So. Yeah.
Do you feel like you're missing out on that splurge during COVID? Obviously, a lot of restaurants in New York were able to kind of do the outdoor service, but there's only so many months that you can do that without freezing your tail off.
Yeah, I mean, that one of the reasons people live here is for like, that's like, you know, why it's like, I used to cook, so I cooked a lot, basically, you know, and one of the reasons I live here is because, like, you know, I could cook, but it's not going to compare to the chefs and all the people that are cooking here. They're just so much better at it. It's like, why would I do that? When I like food, I'm a big foodie. So for me, it's like, I'd rather just go to a restaurant. So yeah, it was not the greatest during that period, but, you know, I just cooked for myself and kind of went from there. So
Yeah, if you give Nick a follow on Instagram, you can see his occasional plate of whatever it is that he's eating.
not gonna lie, I'm usually jealous when I see the posts
at the different restaurants. But obviously, you also post a lot about money, and that's what we're talking about today, Nick. And specifically, you begin the new book talking about your grandfather, your grandpa, who was addicted to gambling. Can you talk about that some? Like, was that one of your earliest money memories?
Yeah, and so I don't like remember him. Like, I actually never remember seeing him like in the casino or anything like that. I was very young, but he would do that. And I've heard stories from my father. There's a lot. It's a lot worse than what I painted it out to be. Like stuff where like he would like after he ran out of money, I heard he used to like beg people at the casinos for more money. He had a sickness. He really did, and it's unfortunate, you know, to know that. And you know, he was a very good man. He was a churchgoer. Loved, you know, very religious and everything, but at the same time, like he had his demons, and that was gambling, unfortunately. But I really saw it. I mean, we'd go to the, you know, when I was a child, we'd go to, you know, the horse races and stuff. And so that was me. I liked it because I was seeing little horses run around. I had no idea it was all about gambling and money or any of that. Hmm. Right. But and so for me, most of those memories, I just enjoy because I was with my father, right? And like we would go to the Pomona County Fair, right, in Southern California, and then, or the LA County Fair, sorry, it's in Pomona. And we would just watch the horse races, and my grandfather would be there, would be gambling or whatever. I didn't think anything of it, you know, at the time. But yeah, he just gambled like his whole life. And like I said, it calculated. It's when you see in the book, it's a lot of money that he gave away.
Right.
You know, my father and I sat down. It's like he's gambled away easily over $1 million, easily. And it's kind of crazy to think about that. I understand that's a lot of money in itself, but like just think about what that could have done for, you know, either our family or for, he could have donated some of that, whatever it was. Like there's just a lot of money that was, you know, it was just spent frivolously, in my opinion.
Right. Do you feel like that had an impact on you, like kind of in your earlier years? And certainly, you know, I think kind of like our teen years is when we start to develop opinions and realize things about our past that start to shape us. Do you feel like that had an impact on you as you begin to grow up?
Yeah, like I never gamble. I've never gambled a single dollar like in my life. The only thing I've ever done is like I've done like poker games with my friends or something, but that's more like for the soul. Like paying the $50 is like a social thing. It's not like I look at it as like I'm losing my money. I'm not like, oh my God, I'm going to come out of here and make. I just take it as an L and just go in there and have fun. So, but yeah, I think it affects just how you think about money and you realize like, and then once I started learning probability and like, oh, you know, when you're gambling, there's a negative, what we call expected value. Like you're expected to lose money per play on average over the course of your lifetime, right? So once you learn that, then you're like, oh, no wonder. And like, this is how all these fancy casinos were built, you know? And I really loved Vegas as a kid because if you're in Southern California and you don't have a lot of money, your vacation is you go to Vegas, right? You go to Vegas. It's a 4-hour drive, you do it. And that's like your vacation, right? So I used to go to Vegas a lot. I just loved the, you know, I was a little kid. I wasn't gambling or anything. I was like, just loved the lights and the casinos and how fun it was. It was very family oriented in the early 90s. So for me, it was like, that's where we went a lot. And so I love that stuff. And now I know how those casinos got built, you know,
right. Yeah.
People like my grandfather gambling, unfortunately.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that. And yeah, it does kind of, it sets up your book in an interesting way. But the main topic in your book, that you're really trying to combat is that, you know, when you buy matters. We're talking about investing, right? And so we were joking before we started recording that I don't think anybody has like spilled more ink when it comes to the topic of buying the dip than you, Nick, on your blog. But yeah, let's talk about like kind of timing the market a little bit and why is that something? Like if you go on personal finance Twitter, you're going to see a lot of people like, you know, the market's down 2% today, buy the dip. And you kind of think that that's just nonsense. So yeah, tell us why you're kind of against that mentality.
I think the whole issue with buying the dip, and I mean, this is, you'll discuss in the book I've written on this, is basically like, if you have cash to buy the dip, that means you had all this excess, like investable cash, that is, right? Sitting on the sidelines, not earning you anything, and you're waiting for this dip to happen. Now, 2% dips are small, they happen all the time, you know, so that's nothing major, but right. Most of the time as you're waiting for this dip, and if it never shows up, you end up sitting in cash for a very long time. So, you know, I think it's more of like the buy the dip movement is more of like a cultural thing than an actual great investment strategy. I think it's funny in itself. But I mean, if you're sitting on a lot of cash, like I'm waiting for the next big 10% dip, statistically, by the time that dip comes, you're going to be buying higher than when you could have bought originally. And I think a good example of this is I remember I was writing, you know, when I actually wrote a post called Just Keep Buying. You know, it's literally going to come out. So 5 years to the day of when I wrote that post in April 2017.
Oh, wow.
5 years later, the book comes out. Very ironic, right?
That's perfect. Yeah.
It's funny because the book was at my book was actually supposed to come out in February, but because of the supply chain crisis, there wasn't paper, all this stuff that happened, you know, Suez Canal, all that stuff. It affected everything. Because of that, it got pushed 2 months. And I'd like, oh, that's weird. And then I looked, I was like, wait, that's the exact same day, like five years prior.
It's perfect.
Yeah, it's wild.
Was your book stuck on the Ever Given?
it was probably stuck on that. Yeah. So basically, like, I wrote that 5 years ago. And people then were like, markets are overvalued. This is crazy. You can't be buying. Since then, the market's up, has doubled basically. It's up 100%, right? And even if, here's the craziest part. Even if you had the foresight to know, hey, March 23rd, 2020 is going to be the biggest dip we've had in the last, you know, decade. I'm going to wait. So even if you had waited since I wrote that post, you know, or beginning of 2017, and you had waited until March 23rd, 2020, and you had bought then, you still would have purchased at a 7% higher price on the lowest day during the biggest crash we've had in the last decade than if you had just bought at the beginning of 2017, like I had originally said. Wow. So, of course, that's not always going to happen, right? If you had bought in 2019, you would have been better to wait. But you're not going to know when the bottom is. You're not going to know how. Like, this is a ridiculous, like, I'm already setting up the premise as being a ridiculous, you know, statement in itself, right? And the fact that
it's like if you knew the future,
like if you knew the future, you still would have like underperformed. It would have been suboptimal to wait that long. You could have just bought earlier, you know. So
if you knew the future, you wouldn't have bought that Tom Brady touchdown football, you know. A couple of the quotes that you give when you're talking about that in the book, you say, buy investments like you buy food, which I think is just like a really good way to think about it. And then you go on to say, even God couldn't beat dollar cost averaging. And it's like, you know, and when we talk about dollar cost averaging, can you define that for us and maybe just kind of, give your thoughts on just like doing it consistently and why that's just the best route to go.
Yeah. So I have a little bit of a beef with the term dollar cost averaging, not in a bad way, but because there's technically there are two definitions. When people say dollar cost averaging, there's two different forms of dollar cost averaging, right? The dollar cost averaging that I support, which is like you're just buying consistently with as you get money. So basically, if you're buying your 401k every 2 weeks or whatever, every once a month, that's I consider that dollar cost averaging. But what you're really doing is you're taking a small lump sum payment and putting it in every time. The other definition, which a lot of people use as well, is like, let's say you just sold a company and you have $1 million or something. You got an inheritance of $100,000, whatever it is. Instead of putting that $100,000 into the market right now, you slowly average into the market. So I'm very specific in the book. I call that averaging in versus dollar cost averaging because it's very confusing. When we say dollar cost averaging, people mean two different things. So when I talk about dollar cost averaging, I'm just talking about just buying over time. It's like just keep buying. They're basically the same thing. I just think the branding of just keep buying is a little bit better and there's less syllables. Mm-hmm. So that's helpful.
I mean, marketing matters. Yeah.
Yeah. Marketing. I think marketing matters. And so to say dollar cost averaging, that doesn't make any sense, but just keep buying is a little bit clearer. And that's basically just rebranding that and trying to show with data why that's true. But so why I believe in it's just like you're buying over time and generally most markets, you know, across the planet go up over time. There are other course exceptions. I know them all. Don't worry. You know, you're gonna be like, what about Greece in, you know, 08 to 2018? I know about that. What about Russia in the last 2 months? It went down 80%. Yeah, I know about that. What about Spain? 73, 83. Yeah, I know. Like Japan, like trust me, I know them all. I've studied them. I study the nightmares. They happen, but they're rare. And so most markets, most of the time is across the world generally go up. So if you're a diversified investor, you'll probably do fine, even if you have a couple markets that don't do as well. So that's kind of the main theory of owning assets.
If you're betting on that downside too, like, and you, then it's less about like when to put money in, and it's more like you should be putting your money towards a root cellar and non-perishable foods, right?
Yeah, exactly. Canned goods, guns, and ammo. Yeah.
Right. Right.
Well, one of the alternatives to investing, Nick, is just taking that money and sticking it in the bank. So we kind of wanted to talk about savings here for a second, because in your book, Chapter 1, it's subtitled, Why Saving is for the Poor and Investing is for the Rich. And then you follow up in Chapter 2 saying that you should be saving less than you think. And so, yeah, talk to us a little bit about your disdain for saving money.
I wouldn't say there's a disdain.
I don't know. Okay. I caught it loud and clear in the book.
Yeah, I think when I say savings, there's a lot there to unpack. So when I say savings for the poor, investing is for the rich, you'll see in the first chapter, that is a relative statement. That is not an absolute statement. So when I say savings for the poor, you have to like every person. I basically create this idea called the save invest continuum, and everyone is on this continuum, like regardless of, you know, what they're doing in their financial life. Everyone's on the continuum. You got to figure out where you are. And the question is like, okay, how much money can you save in the next year? That's like a dollar amount. Let's say you could save, you know, $500 a month over the next 12 months. Okay, $6,000. Okay. The other option is, okay, how much money can my investments earn me in the next year? So let's say you have $20,000 invested and you own, and you're going to get, you know, 5% a year, let's say, right? That's $1,000. So remember, you could save $6,000 or your investments can earn you $1,000. So it sounds like what you need to do is you need to get your investments to earn you more, right? They need to earn you more money. You want to remember, try to move to more passive income. You're trying to like become financially free. All of that is like moving money from one column to the other, right? You want more investment income. To do that, you have to save more money and then you have to invest that money, right? And so savings for the poor is like when you're relatively poorer or when you're like younger, especially, you're not going to have much investment income. So you need to focus on your savings. You need to spend a lot of time thinking about how to save money. And I think that's really going to come from income, but you're going to save money, get it invested, that, and then over time, that's going to build and you're going to start earning a lot more from your investments. So that's one piece of that. So when I say savings for the poor, investing's for the rich, by the time you're like have a lot of money coming in from investments, like the rich have to care a lot more about their investments because their savings can't affect like their lifestyle as much anymore. You know, like Elon Musk's savings rate has no impact on his lifestyle at all. It's right. All about
zero bearing on his
like,
future wealth.
Yeah. It's not like, oh my gosh, I need to, you know, cut out my spending here. Like, no, it doesn't matter. It's all about what happens to Tesla and all his other investments, right?
When I saw that he sold seven houses and it, he netted like $130 million, I'm like, that means nothing to him.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. So I'm saying, I can use extreme examples. Like someone that has no money, all that matters to them is how much they can save. Like they can have the greatest investment portfolio in the world, but if you have $1,000 to invest, it's irrelevant, right? So
that's
that point, right? So those are obviously on the extremes. It's very obvious. For most of us, we're not on those extremes. We're probably somewhere closer to the middle. And so you have to figure out where you are and where you spend your attention. I, for example, have to spend time on both, right? I'm at a point now where like, you know, I basically can save as much as my investments earn me, but like there's a really bad year in the market. Like on paper, I will lose more than I could save in a year, you know? So, and that really depends, right? And that's kind of scary, but that's where you have to think about both of them, right? And most people, you should see that early on. You shouldn't spend that much time on your investments in terms of like, yeah, get them, you know, figure out what to invest in, buy some stuff, low cost index funds, etc. But don't obsess over them. What you should be obsessing over is your career and other things you can do to earn more money. That's what I think you should be obsessing over when you're young. As you get older, you can care less about that and more about your investments.
Yeah, so. I was going to say, can we talk about growing the income? Because that's something you talk about a lot too, right? Is you do talk about making more money, earning more money, and how frugality maybe is even like overdone. Maybe we talk about that too much in the personal finance space, and how growing the, you know, how much you're bringing home every single month, every single year, how maybe that's even more important.
Yeah. So I think if you look at the data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, basically, if you just like look at, okay, how much, if you look at like the bottom 20% of households, like they spend more than their income than they bring in, right? And you look at like, I actually put the amounts in there. Here's how much they spend on rent, here's how much they spend on food, etc. The amounts aren't ridiculous. These people aren't living these lavish lifestyles. And it's like, oh, you know why? If they just cut their spending, they would be rich. Like it's not true. It's just the data is not there. It's just a lot of these people, like how do they spend more than their income? Well, they take out debt. That's how consumer credit card debt and different types of debt, or they borrow from friends or something. There's debt there, right? It's the only way it can be done. You know, obviously the bottom 20% of households changes over time. Some of those people are college students. They'll get jobs later. Some have a low paying job. They'll get a higher paying job, right? People are always moving out of, you know, where they are in life. But if you look at the data, like cutting spending works a little bit, but for most people, it's not going to be the way you build wealth. And I love the examples of like, oh my gosh, like look at these celebrities, like, you know, Lindsay Lohan or Nicolas Cage, all these people like went bankrupt or almost bankrupt multiple times just because of all their spending. It's like, it's all about spending. It's like, yeah, you have like five or six or maybe even 10 examples of celebrities who went bankrupt, but like, what data do I have? I have every other celebrity. Every other celebrity is not bankrupt. Like, why? Because they have high income. So like, yes, if you have really bad spending habits, like, yes, you can, you know, get into ruin. But for a lot of people, it's income. Really, it's income that's driving that. And I think the data is pretty clear, right? And so like a lot of the arguments I try to make is based on what I know and not like what we assume, right? Like we can be like, oh, you know what? The Rock, you know why he's so rich? Because he has a great money mindset. It's like, no, The Rock's rich because he has an incredible income. And I can tell you that there's his money mindset might be average at best. We have no idea. But what we do know is he has a high income. Right. And so that's a lot of my arguments, like what's actually true that we know versus like what's assumed about people. That's like why I'm not against frugality at all. Obviously, some people are just like that. Like even now when I go to McDonald's, I still order off the dollar menu, even though I can afford Because, like, I did that with my father, and I still order off the dollar menu. Like, it's a weird thing. Like, I always did because, like, we didn't have a lot of money. And so it was like, oh, yeah, oh, you always order off the dollar menu. So to this day, I still get, like, the McDouble and the McChicken and all that stuff. Right? So,
wait till they start having some of that dry-aged steak on the dollar menu.
The dry-aged McRib. Oh, we haven't even gotten to that right now.
Just for you.
Nickel splurge on that.
Yeah, yeah. And so, and then getting back to the one quick question earlier, you were talking about, like, oh, do I have a disdain for savings? And I just think if you look at some of the data there, like, I think a lot of people save too much. I mean, only 1 in 6 retirees are drawing down principal, which is kind of shocking. But like from Social Security and everything else, like if you have money like in these accounts, so many people end up, their assets grow as they retire. And you're like, what shouldn't you be spending your money down? Everyone talks about, oh, using the 4% rule, spending your money down. You look at the data, most people aren't doing that. Like most people take their RMDs and they just reinvest it. Their wealth is growing over time. I think Michael Kitsy's at this thing where it's like, your wealth is just as likely to 4X as it is to go to zero. Like that's how crazy it is. Like they're equally likely, you know, if for someone who's using the whatever the 4% rule or some rule like that. Right. So I'm just like, it's not that I'm against saving. I just think I know people that are doing very well and they're acting like they are not doing well at all. And I think if you look at the data, you realize just like how fortunate so many people are. And like, I think people obsess over it too much.
Yeah, no, I agree. Especially as you start to build more wealth, it can be difficult to get out of that mindset, right? And that's the problem that those retirees are dealing with. They have spent their entire lives going in one direction, and all of a sudden they have to kind of on a dime switch. Like how are you supposed to go from forward? Like you've been going forward your entire life, and now you got to flip it into reverse. The backup beep starts beeping, and you feel like that something is wrong.
It's like mental gymnastics to start drawing down on the funds you've been investing and saving up for 4+ decades.
That's a big reason why here on the show. I mean, we often talk about finding balance in our lives, even when we are most clearly in that wealth building stage, but like you still have to incorporate some little splurges, whether that's craft beer, whether that's dry aged steak. And Nick, we're actually going to talk about some of the different ways that we can spend our money, some of the ways that it can maybe be healthy, but some of the ways too that it could lead to our financial downfall. And we'll get to all of those questions right after this break.
Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000 plus 5-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in 5 delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's kachava.com/howtomoney. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. And now a word from the show sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
Joel, longer days and warmer weather, it means our family is spending a lot more time outside. It's great. Like, literally yesterday, I was in the front yard, Kate was in the garden, and I was kicking the soccer ball around with a couple of the kids. I'm loving it. But something else that you can do for your family this spring, shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius as part of your financial planning for the year. Kate and I both have policies in place, and that means we have peace of mind so that if something were to happen to either of us, our family can cover expenses while getting back on our feet.
Yeah, with Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Even if you already have a life insurance policy through work, by the way, it may not have enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. On top of that, Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies. That means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
That's right. So save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
All right, we're back from the break. Still talking with Nick Majuli. We're talking about why you should save less money, because saving is for dummies and you should just keep buying.
Wow.
I'm putting words in your mouth. I'm sorry, Nick. You're not saying that. And I appreciate
the nuance. I did say just keep buying everything else. I'm redacted from the record. I use my litigation consulting terms.
So, no, I think that the nuance you provided there is really helpful. And you know, what you're talking about too is basically maximizing the enjoyment of your dollars. And I think it's a great way to think about it. And, you know, what Matt was alluding to, how, you know, we want people to strike balance in the here and now while they're being smart with their money. And that's something maybe, or one of the criticisms that we've had of the FIRE movement over the years is there can be this nose to the grindstone for 10, 12, 15 years to reach this one goal, and you're burnt out by the end of it. And it's really hard to shift gears. And so you should be enjoying along the way. So, what's your take on maybe a lot of the chatter in the personal finance space around deprivation? And then, yeah, talk to us about your views on guilt-free spending.
Yeah, so I think the biggest wake-up call for me, I think, was COVID in a big way. Not for me personally, but just from what I saw. Like, imagine, you know, you're 60 years old, you're out in the Alps, you know, maybe you're going to retire in a year or two, you're like out, you know, somewhere in Italy on a vacation, and this new pandemic breaks out, you get it, you unfortunately pass away. And it's like you had your entire, you know, 20, 30 years ahead of you, retirement now gone, right? All this, you did all the saving, all that. And so think about just how tragic that is. And of course, like, you're doing a vacation, you're spending your money, obviously that's good, right? So, but I think there's a lot of people that are just setting up this thing of like, okay, like, I expect to live to be 89 or whatever. You have some, you run on these numbers and you expect all this stuff. And of course, you should act as if you're going to get there. But at the same time,
sure,
like, you need to be somewhat reasonable too, of like, You're doing all this for something. Like, why are you saving your money? I think a lot of people just do it because that's what they see everyone else doing, and they don't actually think about it. And they don't know, like, what am I saving for? What do I really care about, you know? And so for me, I think spending money purposely is just like figuring yourself out. I think it's really tough. I think, like, even myself, like, I never really considered myself a foodie. Like, historically, I would be like, someone asked me, I'm like, I'm not a foodie. But then I realized, like, oh, actually, I kind of am. Like, I like trying new restaurants. I like doing this. Like, no wonder I live in New York City. It's like all these things you start to figure out about yourself. And so I think this is really more of an introspective thing you have to think about. Like, what are you really doing this for? And I think a lot of people don't really know. Because, like, okay, you want, oh, I want free time to do whatever I want. I'm like, okay, well, what's whatever you want? Okay, let's say I have a magic wand. I grant you your free time right now. What are you going to do all day? You know, I'll tell you what I do. I'd still be writing. I'd still be doing the same stuff. I'd still be wanting to probably work in a financial services firm. You know, I'd probably still work for my firm. I like trying to help people. I believe in our mission. Like, you know. So I think you have to figure that out. And once you figure that out, then spending the money is easy. You're like, oh, I care about these things, so I'm willing to spend big, which is like why I love that question you guys start every pod with. It's like, what are the things you like to splurge on? Because you're grounding it in, like, do you know yourself, really, is the question.
Yes.
And so I think you guys both know what you guys like to spend money on. Like, I think a lot of your audience, I'm assuming, knows, like, you know, I really like spending money in a couple categories. But figuring out those things, I think, is the most important. So in terms of guilt-free spending, one of the rules I like to use, and I think this is a very simple rule, it's just called the 2X rule. And basically, if you're saving, if you want to splurge on something, let's say I want to go out to like a really nice, like, sushi tasting, an omakase, right? It's going to be like $250 a person. And so, like, let's say I'm going on a date with this girl or something. We've been seeing each other a little while. I'm like, okay, we're going to go out. So I'm going to spend $500 on this. You're like, that's crazy. That's so much money. I'm like, well, before I spend that, you know, let's say it was an anniversary dinner or something. Before I spend that, I'm going to save up another $500 and I'm going to invest in the market, or I'm going to donate it or something like that. You save up additional 2x what you're supposed to save. So that when I spend that $500, I don't feel guilty about it. I'm going to say, you know what? Yes, I spent more than I probably should have normally, but at the same time, I invested some money. So I'm doing something to kind of pay off my guilt, basically. So you don't have guilt. And so I do this all the time, and I don't have guilt about how I spend money. I really don't. And I used to, especially like when I was, you know, much younger, I used to feel guilty about it. I remember even I was at a music festival once, and I didn't want, like, the beers were $9, like, because it's a music festival, you know, that's how it is, right? And I was like, I don't want to spend $9 on a beer. That's crazy. But, and I ended up not doing that. Like, we ended up, like, doing, you know, I was like, why did I do that? Like, looking back now, it's like a regret I have. Like, I should have spent the $9 on a beer, whatever. But it's like thinking about that, it's like the, it was that mindset of not kind of just, hey, just enjoy the moment. It's just $9. Like, that, how much is that $9 going to change me now? Not at all.
Yeah. In the moment, that's a really fun thing to get to enjoy. And I agree. Like, I was so frugal, especially in my early mid 20s. And I still, like, think frugality is a great thing. And it's something we talk about here a lot on the show, because I do think that's an important part of the puzzle, especially when you're, like, broadcasting to a whole bunch of people. Like, a lot of people need to know how to live more frugally. And there are specific ways to do that better. But at the same time, I had to realize, like, well, what am I saving this money for? What am I investing for the future for? And you have to be able to enjoy the here and now at the same time. And if you're not doing that, and if you feel guilty every time you try to spend money on something you enjoy, it almost like drags it down and makes it way less fun. It's almost like, it's just like a mental bummer, a big drag on the joy that you're trying to get from the money you have worked hard to earn. And so you have to find that balance. And it's, you know, it's not always easy, but I think it's something people should strive for. And I like your 2X rule, because it does kind of allow people that mental freedom to enjoy the things that they actually do love while they're, you know, while they're doing, trying to, you know, be smart with their money.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what I say. And just focus on things that provide you fulfillment. So whatever that is, it's for some people, I think there's this whole like experience. There's a war on like buying material goods, and it's like, oh, you know, only experiences. The data shows experiences, and don't get me wrong, I understand the data, I've seen it, and it looks like people prefer buying, spending more experiences than goods, but that's not true of everyone. I mean, that's an average result. Like, some people really like nice cars. I'm not one of them, but some people do. And I think if you're one of those people, like, don't feel bad splurging on a nice car. Or if you're one of the people that likes a nice handbag, don't feel bad about that just because the data says, oh, well, 80% of people prefer this. You might be an exception to that rule. So, like, don't get me wrong. I love using data, relying on data, but it's not perfect. Remember, it's only going to get the average result, right? That's why experiences might be great for extroverts. And since most people are extroverted, that's going to look great there. But there's going to be a small subset of the population that's much more introverted that won't get as much out of experiences in the same way. So you have to really know yourself. I think that's more important. And then optimizing for that with your money versus, like, just taking what society says all the time.
Yeah. Well, if 80% is extroverted, well, there's your 80%.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as folks who are willing to spend on experiences. And I mean, you're kind of getting at this, Nick, but like, how would you recommend for somebody to ask themselves that question? Like, I mean, what we're talking about here is like serious, like real soul searching, essentially. And to, you know, for us to determine and to figure out what is it that brings us fulfillment. Like, do you have any practical suggestions for folks to determine that for themselves?
I mean, this is a question that they've been asking for centuries and millennia, really. This is a philosophical.
How
Socrates
do I live a good life?
Know thyself, right? It's like, this is like, stoicism's coming back with Seneca and all these philosophers. And it's like, these are old ideas that we've been asking ourselves as humans for a long time. And so, I don't know. I think a lot of this is just like exploration, trying new things, seeing what you like, what you don't like, figuring out what systems work for you, what doesn't. I mean, that's really it. So for me, I mean, that's why I have generally lived in big cities, because like there's a lot of experiences, a lot of things you can try, and you figure out what you like and what you don't like. And that's kind of it, really. And if you never kind of explore certain things, you'll never know, really. And so, of course, you can't explore everything. It's impossible to explore every option. Like, I've never lived in Atlanta. For all I know, that could be my favorite city in the world, right? Like, I have no clue.
We'll show you a good time. Come on down.
Yeah, exactly. It's an invite. That's how I get myself invited down. But there's limits to this, obviously. But there's within that, you know, you can still say, like, okay, I know I like this. I don't like, for example, I know I don't love driving. So it's going to be really tough for me not to live in a place where I have to drive, you know, or commute an hour every day, you know, or something like that. So like just knowing yourself and knowing what you care about, like, oh, just being able to, like, you know, my gym is two blocks away. My grocery store is three blocks away. Like everything near me is a block or two away. And so for me, I care about just being able to walk to everything. And so like that's, I value that so much. And so I don't have a car and all that, and I pay for it in rent. Or you're paying for it somehow. You just got to figure out where you're paying for it, right? And so for just knowing what you want, I think is the key. So just, I mean, spend time on it. There's no easy way. I wish I could be like, oh yeah, when I was 22, when I was 22, 23, I had no clue. It took me a decade to even get to here, and I'm still learning every day. So it's a process.
Yeah, like it's not like one day you wake up, the scales fall from your eyes, and you're like, I get it. I know what life's all about right now. And so it takes time along on a continuum to find more and more what you're into. But I think part of the key is not just blindly or numbly doing what everyone else around you is doing. And I think that is a pattern people fall into. Well, my neighbor Bill just got a boat. I guess it's time for me to do something similar. And kind of really marching to your own drummer is part of it.
And just to add on to that too, Nick, I mean, what I hear you saying is, and what you're saying too, Joel, is that you don't have to, like, don't beat yourself up. You're right. Like you said, like, we're not going to get it right away. It takes a number of years to figure this thing out, and we're going to make mistakes, you know, and like, we're going to look back into our past and say, oh, that was so stupid. I can't believe I spent that much money on X, on that car.
Or I literally still look back to when I bought a Sega Dreamcast for my friend growing up, and I'm like, what a waste of money. Cause I was
such an idiot.
I played it for like 3 weeks, and I'm like, what if I had that $150 back? And those are the kind of things
you don't know.
Exactly.
You don't know. And that's what I hear Nick saying though, is like, I think,
Let it inform your future, though.
This is informing my big takeaway for the end of the episode. But like, yeah, be willing to experiment here. And I appreciate what you're saying there, Nick.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's going to be waste when you do that. There's going to be waste. You know, it's like, if I remember I had a friend who was like really into watches, and he bought a bunch of different watches, and then he only wears one now. He like never wears the other ones. And I was like, and it was like, oh yeah, you waste all that money. But no, he figured out, oh, I like this watch the best, and I like wearing it. And so he just got rid of the other one. So it's like, there's going to be waste involved in the process. You're not going to optimize it perfectly. Trust me, as someone who's like cares about optimization, I'm like always thinking about that stuff. Like, you have to just let it go. It's some cost. It happened. So.
Yep. All right. Well, you already kind of you've created one piece of financial personal finance heresy in kind of how you talked about savings for a second, Nick. But you
you keep like putting words in his mouth.
I do. I'm sorry, Nick. I'm sorry. He's never coming back on the show.
He won't.
But you share some interesting thoughts on debt and why you actually mentioned that credit card debt isn't necessarily an awful thing. And so, all right, I want to hear your reasoning behind that, because that is kind of a surprising take. I got your reasoning in the book, but can you share it with our listeners?
Yeah. So I think, and now trust me, this is a big preface. It's an exception based argument. So generally, credit card debt is not a good thing. I will say that. That's obviously true. Most people know that already. Not everyone knows that. However, for example, let's say there's someone that has $1,000 in their checking account, and they also have $500 in credit card debt. Looking at this, you'd say, well, if you're paying 20% a year or 30% a year on that credit card debt, you should just pay that off, right? You have $1,000 cash, you have $500 in credit card debt, you know, you net that out, you're going to have $500 cash and no credit card debt. Isn't that better, right? It's very obvious. The problem is, in that particular example, it actually might make sense for that person to have credit card debt. What they're called in the academic literature is borrower savers, because they're borrowing, yet they have cash that they could pay off their debt with. And the reason is, like, it might be a liquidity issue. Let's say all of a sudden, a week later, they get hit with their car breaks down. They have to spend $700, right? And if they don't spend that $700, they can't get to work and they can't earn their money. So now, if they only had $500, they can't do that now. But with $500 in credit card debt and $1,000, they can. So it's more of a liquidity problem. And so I think there's a lot of times where we make blanket claims in the personal finance space. And of course, remember, this argument is obviously extreme. I know this is an extreme argument, but the point I'm trying to make is, there's a lot of times we make blanket claims like debt is bad, or credit card debt is bad, or don't max your 401k and we can get into all of that. A lot of these things are blanketed, and I think there's exceptions where they're not always true. And just to think about, like, when do those exceptions exist? And, you know, I like to challenge like a lot of the fundamental principles in personal finance, because I feel when everyone's saying the same thing over and over and over again, we need to question whether that's actually right once in a while. It kind of goes back to first principles. I'm not saying like it's wrong. I think generally, yes, credit card debt is bad and you should not be racking up a ton of credit card debt. So like that's like, to me, that's very obvious. But if someone has $1,000 and they have $500 in credit card debt, if you're like, you know what, you should pay off that credit card first thing, maybe not. Maybe get your emergency fund first and then consider paying off the credit card debt. Is it optimal mathematically? No, but it's probably optimal from a risk perspective, right? And so it's like figuring out, what are we actually solving for? If we're trying to like maximize dollars, yes, you should pay off the credit card first. But there's a chance that you get hit with something and now you're even in a worse position than you were beforehand, right? Where you don't have liquidity and you can't pay for something and now you lose your job, et cetera. Now you're really in a bad spot. So that's kind of the example I give. And I don't know how many of your listeners are in even something like that or even close to that, but it's just a point of thinking about this more critically, which I think is kind of lost in the personal finance space sometimes.
Yeah, there's mm-hmm. also just like some peace of mind, right, with cash on hand that comes along for people. And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think sometimes maybe we rush because we've heard that blanket advice. And yet there is it's so tough to just give blanket advice to everyone because there are so many specific nuances in situations. I think – I don't know which our favorite episodes are, but we love the listener questions episodes because it gives us a chance to kind of take a more nuanced approach to a topic because we have a specific situation we're dealing with and you know, blanket advice doesn't apply always to everyone.
Yeah, the general first principles still hold, but in your case, let's tweak it a little bit because this is what it sounds like would be, you know, optimal for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all right, hey Nick, we've got a few more questions we want to get to for you, including mostly about investing, and we'll touch on crypto as well. You left it out of your list of investable assets in your book. So we're gonna talk about why mm-hmm. you did that and more right after this break. Kachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Kachava really earns their 52,000-plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Kachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Kachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Kachava. Just go to kachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A and get 10% off your first order. That's kachava.com/howtomoney. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
All right, we're back from the break. We're talking with Nick Majuli. His book, Just Keep Buying, is what we're discussing today. And Nick, you know, like Joel mentioned, we want to talk about investing a little bit more. Specifically, like one of the main questions that we get here on the show, oftentimes it's for folks who want to save up for a big purchase, which usually means they're saving up for a down payment on their home. It's like everyone out there, they want sort of like a magic bullet answer when it comes to how they can grow their money without there being any risk. But what advice would you give for folks who are looking to purchase sometime soon?
Yeah. So if you're purchasing, I mean, I looked at some of the data on this over, you know, going back to like, you know, the 20s in terms of like what returns you got if you had invested that money in bonds or in stocks while you're saving, et cetera. And generally, my rule of thumb is that if you're planning to do the purchase in the next 3 years, it should be in cash. Because, I mean, most of the time, yes, it probably would have been better to be in bonds. Like, but there's some risk involved. You may have to save a couple extra months in case, you know, something happens and bond prices crash in some way, right? Versus cash, that's not really going to happen. Yes, there's inflation. So that's why it generally takes a little, like 1 month longer on average to save up for, I don't know, let's say, you know, 40, 50 grand than it would take if you're doing it in bonds. So under a 3 year period, I say use cash. You're doing 3 to 5 years. You now need to start having bonds or some other sort of instruments. And then 5 years beyond, you might have some stocks, right? So that's kind of like the go-to way of thinking about it. I think it all comes down to risk, right? It's like, what risk are you willing to take and when? And so that's why I generally recommend, you know, if you're saving up for something, just put it in cash. I know right now that's can be really scary because like, wow, inflation's, you know, 7.5% or 8% a year. And so it's like your cash is being eaten away and that sucks. But, you know, you could be putting into something else where it's very risky. And so that's true now. We don't know what the future is going to hold. Just because inflation's 8% now doesn't mean it's going to be 8% next year or higher or lower. We don't necessarily know. So
yeah,
that's my kind of go-to is like use cash.
Okay. And when we talk about just keep buying, like you're basically a big fan of buying index funds, which, mm-hmm. you know, Matt and I, we feel the same way. But why, I want to hear your take on why you think they're best for most folks, like, because, yeah, there's a whole lot of things people can invest in, and index funds, certainly simple, easy to understand. But yeah, why do you think they're so great?
I just think low-cost index funds and ETFs are the way to go for most people because they're easy. They're generally cheap if you find the right ones. I'm not going to put any names out there. There's plenty of providers that provide cheap exposure to both U.S. and international equities and REITs, which is real estate. And many other assets, right? You can get farmland REITs. You can get all sorts of exposure to different asset classes for very cheap. And I like them because it's easy. I mean, literally, you just go into a brokerage account. You know, you go into your Schwab or your Chase, your whatever, et cetera, whatever, Fidelity, whatever you have. You go in there and you just, you know, put in the symbol and you buy it, right? It's as easy as it could be, you know? Of course, you can do that with mutual funds and other things, but I think the tax efficiency, there's a lot of benefits that, you know, I don't want to get into all that right now, but like there's a lot of benefits to just low cost index funds that it just makes it really easy. You're getting cheap diversification, and that is that's the key. Cheap diversification.
Yeah, we like cheap. Especially, I mean, again, I keep thinking about just my mind keeps going back to the conversation around frugality. And oftentimes it is such an important thing to keep in mind, especially early on when you aren't necessarily making a ton. But as your wealth grows over time, like that's not something you need to pay much attention to. But it does. It is something you need to pay attention to as your portfolio grows as well. Because when you start looking at expense ratios on large sums of money, that is some serious amount of money that you can be separated from over the years. So you mentioned index funds. I also appreciate, Nick, how you share your single stock picks mm-hmm. on Instagram. You highlight some of your, you know, some of your stinker investments. For instance, Rent the Runway. Do you mind sharing a little bit about those and kind of how you view those individual companies?
Seems like you got a relationship with Rent the Runway.
No, I don't have any relationship with these companies. So for the record, chapter 12 is called Don't Buy Individual Stocks, and this is example why. So yes. No, I did this for fun. So I own two individual stocks. And I'm not saying this to pump them. I'm not saying they're down badly. So they're down like 70% each. So I'm not worried about that. But I'm saying I own two individual stocks. One's Matterport. One's Rent the Runway. Matterport's like an augmented reality thing. Anyways, I don't recommend individual stocks because I think it's very difficult to beat performance-wise. And also, you don't know if you're actually going to be good at doing it for like a professional standpoint. However, I put, you know, 1% of my investable assets and into these two companies. So a very, very small percent, you know, 1% of everything I own. So not risking the farm, so to speak. And I kind of talk about this in the book. But I got into Matterport because I had a bunch of friends getting into it. So we kind of did it as like a social thing, and it was kind of a, you know, a thing we laughed about and stuff. So it was like kind of cool, but also it's like an investment. And the other one, Rent the Runway, I remember it was like, oh, and this is my Peter Lynch moment. Like I remember an ex-girlfriend who was always using it, and this was like pre-COVID. And I was like, as soon as this thing IPOs, I'm going to buy it no matter what. I know right now COVID's still happening, and like it's probably not the best time to buy it because people aren't going out again, but like I'll just do it anyway. So I did. I put a little bit of money in there and it's down badly. Both are just getting crushed. So if anything, you know, even when you write a book or a chapter about how you shouldn't buy individual stocks, some people still do it. So I wish I just listened to myself. So that's all I'm going to say. So that's my only thing to say on those. I'm not trying to pump those companies or anything. So.
Right, right. And obviously you're not trying to pump them or anything like that. But I mean, the way we approach it is like, honestly, 1%, like you're saying, that is nothing.
Yeah.
And if that keeps you from making larger, more costly mistakes down the road, if that keeps you on track with the, you know, with the 99% of the rest of your portfolio, then a 1% pressure relief valve can be an incredibly helpful thing that keeps you from just exploding the instant
the whole
pot.
Mustang, yeah.
Yeah. So I say, do it for all fun. Over the place. Yeah. If you're going to do it, if you want to do it, do it for fun. Take a small percentage of your portfolio. You know, we even say, okay, up to 5%, whatever you want to do, that's fine. But keep it small. Do that, have most of your money in, you know, things that are not going to decline by 75% and stay down 75% for a very long time. So index funds generally don't do that. They have only once in recorded history, and they may do it again, of course, but it's unlikely. And so, you know, if that's happening, I think your investment portfolio is not even the biggest piece of your worries, to be honest with you. So,
right. Yeah, you're worrying about how
your
to
job,
eat,
food.
You still have a job. Yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about going back to the canned goods and guns and all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if that's, is that your advice, stock up on canned goods and guns or no?
Yeah. No, I'm saying no. You should be, so this is, that's actually a controversial, it's not a controversial opinion. It's you should have like at least like, I don't know, 0.1% of your net worth or wealth in like some sort of prepper gear. Like, you know, I have like 28 days of dried food, like in my apartment. I have like a life straw. So if like, that's something you can like take dirty water and you can drink. And like, I could drink out of a puddle in New York City with this thing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
and so it's like, and it'd be clean. So it's a very small amount of money. I spent a couple $100, whatever, doing this. And I remember, it's so funny, during COVID, like right when COVID happened, I had by chance, I had a chemical spill kit. And you're like, what? Why the heck would you need that? Well, there's a chemical attack, right? Something that's crazy, obviously. It's like, but I had this chemical spill kit, and in there was a N95 mask, an actual N95. And I was wearing a mask back in like, you know, early March when everyone's like, oh yeah, you don't even have to wear masks. I'm like, I don't believe that. I'm like, I'm putting this on. Like I've seen, like Asia's been wearing masks for forever. I'm like, I'm taking a mask. And I had this thing on in New York City, and I honestly think it like prevented me from getting it, if I have to be honest. Like
after watching Station 11, it makes me want to.
Yeah, seriously. You probably watch those guys in Traverse City, Michigan, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, I'm going to hang on to this mask.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I think having a little prepperness is okay. Just a little though. I don't like have a bunker or anything like that, or seeds or anything, but like
not going down.
A little prep, I think, is okay. Yeah, having some extra water, having, it's silly, but it's silly until it's not, right? And then it's genius.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about crypto for a sec, because you didn't include cryptocurrency in your list of investable assets. Like you made a list in the book. You know, you talked about a couple of things already: index funds, REITs. Mm-hmm. Why did you leave crypto off? And do you feel about crypto like the same way? Would you say about like individual stocks that it's just supposed to be confined to just a small amount? Or yeah, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah. So I think most of individuals' wealth should be in income producing assets, and so those are things that can obviously produce income. That's like obviously equities, businesses, farmland. There's a host of assets I discuss in the book. And I didn't put things like gold, art, wine, cryptocurrency under that because they're not income producing. Now, that doesn't mean you can't make money in them. Of course you can, right? The issue for me is just it's hard for me to, you know, have most of my wealth in something that I have no clue whether, I mean, where the price is completely based on what other people think it's worth. That's it. Obviously, that's true with equities, right? Even at the end of the day, people are still determining what they price a business at, right? But if there's a business producing profits, there's something there that there's some tether to reality, at least something, right? And you can go back and, it's how Warren Buffett initially got rich. He was finding businesses that he would call net nets, where after you sold everything, you basically you buy the business for less than what you could sell everything for. That's like buying a suitcase that you know has $1,000 in it for $500. You know there's $1,000 in the suitcase and someone's selling it to you for $500. Like you would make that trade all day, and that's what Warren Buffett did, right? So I think there is some tether to reality, and that the money in the suitcase is profits, is income, right? Now, the problem with crypto and art and all these other things, and I put them all in the same bucket, is that, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea whether these are going to be worth things in the future, right? Does that mean you shouldn't own any? No. So I have about 10 to 15% of my assets spread out through some physical art, crypto, and, you know, so those are like the two main ones I do. It's probably about 10% there. And so, yeah, so I think you can own some, like I own some Bitcoin, I own some Ethereum, things like that, but I don't think it should be a bulk of your portfolio. And I think there's even a lot of people in the crypto space that are like, yeah, keep it to 5% because it's extremely risky. And like, and as it goes up, you need to rebalance. Like I, at one point, you know, crypto was 2-3% of my portfolio. It got up to like 8% of my portfolio, right? Because I had a Bitcoin and I sold half of my Bitcoin to kind of rebalance down. And people laughed at me and said, it's crazy. You know, how can you sell? It's going to go to $1 million a coin. It may still do that. Who knows? But I think you need to be prudent and still rebalance and do all the things you would normally do, regardless of what's happening to the underlying price. And right at the price I sold it at, just by chance, you know, is higher than where Bitcoin is at. Well, at least at the day of this recording, I have no idea where it's going to be in a month, right?
Who does?
Yeah. So like it could be above, it could be at 100,000, it could be at 20,000. No one knows, right? So.
Exactly. Nice. Well, Nick, man, this has been a fun conversation. We appreciate you, again, sharing the book with us ahead of time. And if folks are interested in checking it out, where can folks find Just Keep Buying?
Amazon. Yeah, just go to search Just Keep Buying on Amazon. Otherwise, you can get through our publisher at Harriman House as well. So.
Awesome. And yeah, you can check out Nick's weekly blog post Tuesday mornings, right, on ofdollarsanddata.com
yep.
too.
Yep, that's it. It'll be there.
Awesome. Nick, well, thanks for joining us, man. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Thanks, Joel. Appreciate you guys.
Sweet. Awesome, man. What a great conversation with one of our favorite writers. Just the seriously, again, the way Nick writes, it's so enjoyable to read somebody who feels like he's connected to us as like normal people. I think a lot of times finance writers, folks who write about money, it almost seems like they're just a little too quant, like a little too head in the clouds. But the way that Nick approaches money in particular just really resonates with me. So check out his site, like we mentioned, of Dollars and Data.
Yeah, I agree. He uses like a lot of graphs and a lot of data in his writing. But
it's still approachable.
It's very approachable. Exactly. Yeah. And there are a lot of people who or a lot of like super wonky blogs where they're using a lot of charts and language that's almost impossible to comprehend, even for someone who digs money and finance. But Nick's is kind of like that perfect presentation to a wider audience with some of that, you know, nerdier data
it
included.
It is. That's right, man. So, yeah. So on the note, do you have I kind of already hinted at what my big takeaway is going to be. So I'll let you get to yours first.
OK, I think mine literally is to just keep buying. Like that's the title of the book. But it's also one of those things where if you put money in every single paycheck for a long period of time, it is going to have massive impacts on your ability to retire, on your ability to become financially independent. Mm-hmm. Like literally those three words I think are so impactful. And it sounds so simple and it can even start small. Preferably it starts young, like the younger you start, the better off you're going to be. But if you can just keep buying like week in, week out, every paycheck and setting some money aside for your future self, like the difference it makes, because there are so many people who just like think I don't have that much to be able to invest right now. I can only buy a little, so I'm not going to buy any. But you should buy a little, and you should get started, and then you should keep going, keep doing the same thing. And so it's kind of like how getting 1% better every day at the end of a year, you're like, I don't know, 365% better, right? And like it compounds on itself, and that is one of the things that your money invested is able to do for you. Mm-hmm. So just keep buying those index funds, do it regularly, and you're going to be surprised and even potentially amazed years and years and years down the road.
That's so, right.
Simple, yeah. But awesome.
That can just be your morning mantra every morning when you wake up. That's what you say to yourself. Just keep buying. Center yourself a little bit.
Look at myself in the mirror, do the Home Alone slap of the face, and just keep doing it.
Okay, so my big takeaway was going to be when it comes to discovering or figuring out whatever it is that you are going to spend your money on. We kind of touched on I think Nick said like 1 in 6, their portfolios are growing. They're not actually drawing down. And we got to figure out what it is that brings us joy. Like what are the things that are going to bring us joy? What are the things that we're going to spend some money on? And we don't always know, especially right off the bat, what those things are. And so Nick mentioned a few things, but first of all, know yourself. Work on getting to know yourself and what it is that you are finding joy and satisfaction in. But realize that you're going to have to do some exploration. Realize that there's going to be some trial and error along the way where you're not going to get things right. Know that waste will happen. Like there is going to be money that goes to waste. There are going to be inefficiencies. And especially for someone like myself who's a nerd, I don't want there to be any waste. I like for everything to be perfectly rationed, to be portioned out, and for nothing to go to waste. And so that's kind of a difficult pill for me to swallow. But I
sometimes
know
that those attempts at perfect optimization mean you're missing out on enjoyable things you could have otherwise participated in.
Absolutely, yeah. So kind of having an open mind and being willing to just try new things. I feel like it's just a good approach to life as well. Just be willing to say yes to things, especially if you've never experienced them before. It's like, why not? Let's give that a shot. Once you experience it and once you've learned, sure, it would be error upon error for you to continue to say yes to that thing. But before that happens, I think you need to be open to some of those things.
All right, let me just offer one mini tip on top of that. If it's okay. A really expensive thing, try renting it first to see if you like it. So
yeah.
If you're like, I'm pretty sure jet ski is going to make me happy. Or if you're like, I'm pretty sure like having my own fifth wheel is going to make me happy. Whatever it is, like we're going to see the country. Mm-hmm.
There are affordable ways to experiment.
Give it a shot. Yeah. Experiment before you decide like, I'm all in. When you're talking to huge sums of money, that's when you want to be careful before you take the plunge ahead of time.
But, wise words. Yeah, there's a way to trial without error. trial and rent.
Exactly, because if the rental costs you $500 or $1,000 and it
versus
screws up.
Versus $10,000 or $100,000.
Yeah, those are big mistakes and you're going to lose a lot of money on them.
Great tip.
All right, well, that was a great combo with Nick and great takeaways. But yeah, let's get back to the beer that we had while we chatted with Nick. And this one is called La Folie. It's by New Belgium. And this is just like maybe the initial classic sour beer of all time. Matt, what was your take on this one?
You know, I think it's about where I remember it.
Yeah, so, I haven't had it in a few years.
It's been a minute. Yeah, it's been a few years. I remember always enjoying, I think it was Le Terroir.
That was a great one. That's like a similar, it's basically like a sister beer to this one.
It's very similar to this, but yeah, like, so the sour notes that you get with this one, like they're, in my mind, they're a bit more tart. At one point, I almost tricked myself into thinking I was drinking like a little bit of cranberry juice.
Oh.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
so like there's like a tart dryness that sets this beer apart. Like there's no doubting that this is a sour, but personally I wish it was a touch sweeter, maybe a touch more funkiness. I think that's maybe one of the things that you get with a Le Terroir, is that there are just like funkier, more barrel, like woody notes. And so while I enjoyed it, it definitely wasn't my favorite beer, but it is a good introduction to sours in particular if you've never had one before.
I think this is a great intro, and especially if you like oak tones. I do think it has a lot of oak forward flavors going on, and on the label it actually says that it's got like green apple flavors going on, and I'm like, yeah, that's actually true. I'll say that is accurate. That description makes sense to me. But it's also, I think it's like velvety smooth. And so if you're looking for, and I'm sure, you can get this beer in probably all 50 states. So if you're like, I've never tried sour beers, I've heard Matt and Joel raving about them, and you're like, well, which one should I start with? Well, this one is probably a great one because
it's a nice middle of the road sour, easily accessible, easily drinkable,
not too harsh, not too crazy, not too funky, but still delicious. So this is probably one of the first ones I ever had.
Yeah, quite literally, it was the first sour I ever had. I remember thinking, there's no way that people drink this.
Yeah, the first sip, you're like, they're crazy. And then you quickly acquire a taste because it is delicious stuff. And this is definitely a good one to start with. And it's also not terribly expensive. So
yeah. Even though I will say, I don't think they used to put it in this format. It's like
they used to have it in big bottles.
In 750 bottles. And this is a tiny little 375. And it had the cork. It had the cage. It's like they're partaking in a little bit of shrinkflation over here. a little bit less beer for maybe close to the same price.
Yeah,
who knows?
You're probably right. I think the big bottles used to be like 12 or 13 bucks. And this one was 9 at half the size. So
okay.
You're right. Yeah, the price is going up, just like it is everywhere else. But that's going to do it for this episode. For folks who want the show notes, we'll put links to Nick's site and Nick's book on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right. And so that'll be it. Joel, until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
A lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See what makes Minnesota the star of the North. New residents share why they love calling it home at exploreminnesota.com/live.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.